Hello and welcome to Inside Politics. I'm John King in Washington. Thanks for your time on a very busy news day. Big votes to open a year-end sprint in Congress. Today, the House votes to stop a nationwide freight rail strike. Last night, the Senate with a milestone vote to protect same-sex marriage. Also, negotiations underway to keep the government funded. Plus, 6 days to the runoff count in the Georgia Senate race. Early voting already breaking records. And as Republican Herschel Walker faces more questions about where he calls home, the Democrat, Raphael Warnock, ratcheting up the TV pressure.
What the hell is he talking about?
Is he serious? Is he for real?
A werewolf can kill a vampire. Did you know that? So I've been telling this little story about this bull out in the field.
What?
With six cows. And three of them are pregnant.
There's no substance. There's nothing.
It makes me want to laugh, and then it makes me think we're in trouble.
And the TikTok threat. South Dakota's governor cracks down on the popular app. And Washington may soon follow suit because, as you watch those catchy dance videos, odds are China is watching you. We're just moments away from a critical and a controversial vote in the House of Representatives. The House will come back into session momentarily. The legislation at issue immediately would prevent a crippling holiday season strike by railroad workers. That measure uses federal power to require workers to accept a new contract that some of the impacted unions had voted to reject. President Biden asked that this bill be rushed to the top of the agenda for an already consequential year-end congressional session. His reason for that? The strike could begin as early as next Friday, December 9th, and it could cost the economy as much as $1 billion in just 1 week. Also high on the agenda for this session, trying to reach agreement on a government spending plan before a December 16th deadline. The railway legislation is in two parts because of Democratic hesitance to force a contract on their labor movement allies. The first bill does just that, imposes the contract. The second bill, though, addresses the key issue that led several unions to reject the industry proposal. That second bill would require those companies to offer paid sick leave. That second provision, though, faces dim prospects over in the Senate. Let's get straight up to our chief congressional correspondent, Manu Raju. Manu, what should we expect?
Yeah, this is a pretty messy process, but ultimately it seems likely to become law potentially as soon as tomorrow. But there are still some hurdles that need to be overcome. First, in just a matter of minutes here, the House will vote on this consequential legislation to avoid this potentially disastrous strike that could happen for the railways, potentially could be impactful along the supply chain as soon as this weekend if they don't get action in Congress, which means the timing is essential. So in a matter of moments, the House will vote to approve this deal, this tentative deal that was reached in September to between the railway industry as well as the rail workers that was silent on the issue of giving paid sick leave to workers. Now, they will also approve an amendment that would require paid sick leave to workers. That will be approved in the House. But then it'll go over to the Senate, where the Senate can essentially ignore the paid sick leave proposal and approve the underlying bill that is silent on that issue that was agreed to back in September. That is what ultimately is expected to happen, but not without some concern. And there's the administration is sensing that concern. Already the focus is shifting to the Senate as Secretaries Pete Buttigieg of the Transportation Department as well as Labor Secretary Marty Walsh are planning to go to the Senate Democratic lunch in just a matter of moments to try to sell Democratic senators on this issue. Some of them are very concerned that it lacks sick leave. One of those members of the Democratic caucus, Bernie Sanders, plans to offer an amendment to ensure that that actually happens. But Dick Durbin, the number two Democrat, just told reporters that he does not think that the Bernie Sanders amendment has enough support to be adopted to the underlying bill, which means ultimately that this bill could pass without that proposal. And John Thune on the Republican side indicated he does believe that this will ultimately pass, even though he himself has concerns that saying that Congress should not intervene on this issue and that the administration should instead. But the Democrats and Republicans are staring at what could be a disastrous strike and recognizing this may be the only chance to avert that strike. Which is why the expectation is that it will pass possibly as soon as tomorrow in the Senate, but it will still take some negotiation to get there, John, as lawmakers are concerned about the impacts if they don't act.
All right, an important issue, and as you note, a messy process to watch in the minutes ahead and then in the days ahead as well. Manu Raju live on the Hill for us to kick us off. Thank you, Manu. With me in studio now to share their reporting and their insights, CNN's Nia Malika Henderson, Jonathan Martin of Politico, and Leanne Caldwell of The Washington Post. As Manu notes, this was already a consequential year-end session. Now the President of the United States is asking Congress to do this. The Democrats trying to tell the labor unions, we're sorry. Essentially, the paid leave proposal is that we're sorry we have to do this, right?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. This was difficult for Democrats to say, we understand your concern. We also believe and think that you should get paid sick leave. But now is not the time. We are not able to get it done right now. And so that's how President Biden and Speaker Pelosi moved forward. And then there was a lot of consternation among Democrats in the House and the Senate who saying, wait a minute, we have to at least try to give them paid sick leave. And that's why Speaker Pelosi made the move. So we'll see what happens today in the House. It'll go to the Senate. Will Bernie Sanders get his vote on an amendment? Will it pass? There's some Republicans who are talking about supporting it, but getting 10 Republicans, I think that's a big task to get.
Right. And as you were speaking up on the screen there, the reason the president of the United States, who himself is a very pro-labor union guy, says we have to do this. Look at, he says, you know, more than 700,000 jobs would be lost in the first 2 weeks, would cripple supply chains in the middle of December, right before Christmas. Prices would go up, disrupt holiday travel, risk to drinking water, risk to farms and the like. So the president says, I'm your friend, but I have to make this tough choice. Mono just noted Marty Walsh, the labor secretary. He comes out of the labor movement in Boston. He's up there telling guys, sorry, eat your peas.
Yeah, listen, and some union members are fine with this deal. I think there are the 8 unions that agree with it and 4 that don't. And so you've got a situation where you've got this very pro-union president, somebody who's gone into these union halls and talked with these folks saying, listen, you can't get it done. But you also have, I think, the reality, like you said, that so many people would be affected by this. Essentially, Christmas could be ruined by this because of the supply chain and the jobs that would be affected. So they've got to forge ahead and get this done and get it done immediately and essentially tell part of their very important base that they can't actually follow through on something that's very important to Democrats, right? Paid sick leave is very important to the Democratic Party's identity and stuff that they would want to have for workers, but not this time.
Two fast points. I've been struck by the relative silence from the AFL, the umbrella labor organization, which is really giving Biden a kind of wide berth on this and not jamming him on this issue, which tells me that the Biden folks did their politics behind the scenes to sort of keep the AFL somewhat quieted on this. And then secondly, I think it's possible and not perhaps likely, but at least possible that the rail folks could come out of this actually with a better contract than they would have had it not gone to Congress. Because if that that bill comes to the floor and they are able to add the 7 days of paid sick leave and that's voted through, that's going to be a better contract for them than they had before it even went to Congress.
Yeah. Right. Unlikely that part gets through, but at least they get it on the record.
Possibly.
They get the vote. We'll see what happens as it goes. We'll come back to that when the House vote starts. I want to come first, though. I mean, in the meantime, to a historic vote in the Senate last night. Again, it's a crazy packed agenda at the end of Congress here. And so sometimes things can get lost. The significance can get lost. The Senate last night voted to codify same-sex marriage. And you had a number of Republican senators, 12 Republicans, voting for them. You see them right there. Some of them are retiring, others facing pressure from Christian conservative groups, from Catholic groups to not do it. But they decided to vote for this. One of them, Cynthia Lummis of Wyoming, going to the floor to explain how this was a difficult process, but she thinks her yes vote is the right thing for the country.
My days since the first cloture vote on the Respect for Marriage Act as amended have involved a painful exercise in accepting admonishment and fairly brutal self-soul-searching. Entirely avoidable, I might add, had I simply chosen to vote no. For the sake of our nation today and its survival, we do well by taking this step. Not embracing or validating each other's devoutly held views, but by the simple act of tolerating them.
It's a courageous speech, and it's a reflection. Number one, she says, I could have just voted no. In other words, my phone would stop ringing from all these Republican groups saying, don't do this. But a Westerner, more of a libertarian, yeah, saying, why the hell is the government in this business? Let people make their own decisions.
Yeah, I think that's part of the thing. She does come from a libertarian state. She has libertarian tendencies. But what I also heard in her speech is something a little bit more than that. She's also recognizing the divisiveness of this country right now, especially on this issue within the Republican Party. Cynthia Lummis is not someone who I ever thought was going to buck the party. And she did. So that was surprising within itself. And so I think there's the libertarian components. And I also think it seems like she's very troubled with the state of politics right now, especially on such a personal issue.
Does it carry over? You get 12 Republicans to vote for this. Does it carry over on anything else, including they have to deal right at the moment now with, forgive me, America, do you have an omnibus, meaning a spending bill that carries for the whole next year, or a continuing resolution, which is maybe a couple of months or so?
I mean, so many of those 12, as Leanne knows well, are kind of the usual suspects. These are the deal makers who typically are getting their hands dirty on bipartisan bills of a sort of variety of stripes. So it's not terribly surprising.
Can I also just jump in to say there are also politicians who listen? The public opinion has changed on this dramatically, even among Republicans.
No, absolutely.
Some of the interest groups are dug in, but if you go out in America and talk about this issue, especially the idea that the government should tell you.
I agree with that. And you wouldn't have seen, for example, Todd Young from Indiana, Joni Ernst from Iowa, who were both sort of on the front nine of their careers in Congress, I would say. Right. They wouldn't have taken that vote were it not for what you're saying, if the sort of country hadn't changed on the issue. But to your larger question about, you know, will this sort of foster sort of sea changing Congress, I mean, I think it's one more example of the Senate still being the Senate, which is, you know, it's not the House, and they still are able to sort of cut bipartisan deals. And I think you saw that in this Congress, largely because of those people on the screen.
Yeah, I mean, on this, I think it's important to say that this doesn't actually codify Obergefell, right?
Right.
It basically says that states can still discriminate against gay folks who want to get married if you're in a state like Mississippi or the 35 states that say that you can't get married if you're gay. So, you know, I think the real fear still is, are they going to overturn the decision that codified the right to same-sex marriage and said that it was a constitutional right? This is not what that does. I mean, you could essentially find yourself years from now in a situation where somebody in Alabama wants to marry, you know, their partner, and they have to go to New York and do it. So that is still sort of creating different tiers of marriage. So listen, it's something of a mixed bag, I think, for folks. And we'll just see what the Supreme Court does going forward with this.
The court question, whether this becomes an issue again because of something from the court, is a very important point. We'll continue to track the debate in the House on the big rail strike bill. But next for us, guilty verdicts in a key January 6th prosecution. The founder of the Oath Keepers convicted of seditious conspiracy. Several of his deputies also found guilty of other charges stemming from the attack on the United States Capitol. Major convictions in the quest for accountability over the January 6th insurrection. A federal jury yesterday found the Oath Keepers leader Stuart Rhodes and his associate Kelly Meggs guilty of seditious conspiracy for their roles in the Capitol attack. Three other defendants were found guilty of other charges, including obstructing an official proceeding. The seditious conspiracy convictions are a big win for the Justice Department as it prosecutes hundreds of January 6th defendants. And those convictions come as other investigations also are nearing or reaching critical points. Our CNN legal analyst and national security analyst, Kerry Cordero, joins our discussion. Two seditious conspiracy convictions, the others convicted of disrupting, interfering with an official event. This was viewed as the most significant trial, at least to date, in the accountability effort. What is the meaning?
I think it's a huge deal because seditious conspiracy is a charge that the Justice Department doesn't bring frequently. It doesn't bring it lightly. There's actually a little bit of history of a case not working out many, many years ago. And so it was a really big decision for them to go forward. But in my view, it's always been the right part of the law that fits the activities that were conducted on January 6th. 2021. And so what it does is it both sets a precedent for the following cases with other individuals who are also charged in other cases for seditious conspiracy. And most importantly, it provides accountability for the activities that took place. It puts the activities that took place in the right historical context.
You have 919 people who have been charged, considered defendants by the Justice Department. 430 have entered guilty pleas, 460 convicted, meaning trials in the other cases there. This is the interesting part. You have these legal proceedings against those who stormed the Capitol. You have the legal proceedings and a remarkable success rate so far, anyway, by the Justice Department in getting convictions of some kind or guilty pleas of some kind. My question is, what about the people who brought them here? What about the people who paid for it? What about some of the other organizers? Well, there's legal culpability for those who stormed the building. What about everybody else who was a part of it?
Well, I guess we'll have to see what the Department of Justice is doing. We know that there is now there's an investigation into the former president that has now been passed over to the special counsel. So maybe this is going to be in his realm of consideration. We know that the January 6th Select Committee has looked into this. We'll see if that's part of the final report that has to be out very soon before the end of the year. And so, yeah, those are excellent questions. And it's a much bigger problem than the people who actually attended in person.
Right. The chairman, Benny Thompson, says the January 6th committee is making good progress. There's been some disagreement about how to order the report. What should the focus be of the report? Should it have criminal referrals? But he says they're making good progress. You have Trump advisor Stephen Miller called before the federal grand jury yesterday. In Georgia, Mark Meadows, the former chief of staff, who for months and months and months has fought testifying, being ordered to testify there. That gets to the question. You know, there's political accountability, but will there be legal accountability for some of the politicians involved in this?
You know, that, and I think Leanne gets at it well here, and I think most average Americans, after having seen the January 6th committee over those weeks and weeks and weeks, really point a direct line to Donald Trump. He called the mob here and essentially had a vision for what they did and articulated it. Will he be held accountable? That, I think, is the main, you know, sort of big fish that people are wondering about. So we'll see what happens with the proceedings going forward, and then all of the ancillary people who were maybe paying for these people to get here or any of those issues. But listen, I do think this underscores the seriousness of it. You know, we all watched it unfold on TV. We've all seen Republicans try to sort of erase what happened, erase the violent part of it. And here you have really serious charges brought in a conviction for these two folks.
Mark Meadows has always been critical here because he had eyes on so much. He had eyes on the then president, Donald Trump, but also had eyes on so much of the other stuff happening in the West Wing and who was getting to Trump to push these. We know now he has to testify between the special grand jury in Georgia. We know he was on the phone call in which Donald Trump sparred with then and current Georgia Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger about this.
The people of Georgia are angry. The people of the country are angry. And there's nothing wrong with saying that, you know, that you've recalculated because the 2,236 and absentee ballots, I mean, they're all exact numbers that were done by accounting firms, law firms, etc. And even if you cut them in half, and cut them in half again, it's more votes than we need.
Well, Mr. President, the challenge that you have is the data you have is wrong.
Secretary Raffensperger essentially saying, Mr. President, you need better advice. You need better counsel. This grand jury has had considerable success. Lindsey Graham has been forced to testify. Yeah. Now Mark Meadows, who refused to testify, he did give a lot of text messages and documents to the January 6th committee, but refused to testify. Yeah. This grand jury could get a lot of information that we have been unable to get in Washington.
Yeah, no, and it's been striking how much Meadows has been a key player in all this. I mean, it's because of his text messages that he turned over to the 1-6 committee that we know so much about that day. And so it'll be interesting which Mark Meadows shows up to testify down in Georgia when he does go there. But no, I mean, you listen to that call that you just played, and it sort of gets to the sort of tactics that Trump employed in the weeks after the election and sort of why I think a lot of folks in the legal community think he could face some jeopardy here in Georgia.
And the way I pose the question, please tell me if you think it's the wrong way to frame it. But those who stormed the building are being held accountable. Those who maybe encouraged them or brought them here, what is the legal line in the sense of, you know, Donald Trump did not go into the Capitol, so can you charge him with disrupting an official proceeding or anybody around him? I named him because he's central to it, but there are a lot of people who had tangential roles, but where are the legal lines?
Right, so there's different ways that the Justice Department is approaching this. So you have the seditious conspiracy charges, which were about the use of force to prevent the execution of the laws. So that's a really serious charge, and that involves the violent part of what happened. But then there also is an ongoing Justice Department investigation into the efforts to subvert the election itself. And there has been less publicly known and exposed because there haven't been charges on those particular cases brought yet. But that's an ongoing Justice Department investigation. And we'll continue to see whether that affects people who are closer to the political process. But the other piece with respect to the connection between the former president, folks in the White House, and the violence that occurred is the January 6th committee did have an opportunity, if they would have had the evidence, to make those connections between the people like Roger Stone and the Oath Keepers and the other violent groups that stormed the Capitol, and they had many hearings and they never did it. And now we still don't even know whether that type of information is going to end up in the final report.
Well, that's one of the many questions as we await that report. Appreciate that conversation. Right now, I'll show you pictures of the House. They're voting on that legislation aimed at averting a potentially crippling rail strike. We'll keep track of that vote. And next for us, early voting surges in the Georgia Senate runoff as Republican Herschel Walker contradicts himself about the state he calls home. Herschel Walker, you might say, is in a debate with himself in the final days of this final week of the Georgia Senate runoff campaign. You might recall a recent CNN K-File scoop that Walker, in both 2021 and 2022, received a tax break in Texas intended for a primary residence. Now the K-File team reports Walker himself said, quote, "I live in Texas," while speaking to University of Georgia College Republicans earlier this year. And he repeatedly held campaign interviews from his Texas home. But on the campaign trail yesterday, this.
"I represent the great people of Georgia. I've lived here my whole life. I owe so much to the great people of Georgia, to the state of Georgia. Do y'all think I'm going to let you down? I scored one time, and I can score again."
Our great reporters are back with us. You just heard the candidate. That was yesterday. "I've lived here my whole life." This is the candidate in January of this year.
"I was sitting in my home in Texas. I was sitting in my home in Texas, and I was seeing what was going on in this country. I live in Texas. Yeah, I went down to the board off and on sometime."
Can you square that circle?
No, you can't. I mean, he mentioned Texas three times in a very short period of time, describing where he lives. I mean, this is a tough campaign to watch. Herschel Walker was a fantastic football player for the University of Georgia, won the Heisman Trophy, had a fairly good career in the NFL, too. Whether or not he is qualified to be a senator, whether or not he is steeped in any sort of policy issues, I think that'll be up to the voters to decide. But I think so far he hasn't been a very credible messenger. I think a lot of Republicans down there, you saw that in some of the split ticket voting. They voted for the top of the ticket, Brian Kemp, and either didn't vote at all or voted for Warnock. And Warnock is trying to sort of exploit those fissures by pointing to Warnock, Walker's own garbled speech and messaging on any number of topics.
And to that point, number one, we've seen earth-shattering record early voting. For all the times we talk about election denial and other things, we should be happy when people, whatever your party, whoever you're supporting, come out and vote. Those are high numbers that's broken the records as of today. But to your point, the lieutenant governor of Georgia, who is not a Donald Trump fan and not a Herschel Walker fan, let's be quite clear about that, says this, though, about the campaign. "Herschel Walker was granted a mulligan in the form of a runoff, an extra 4 weeks to convince the 200,000 Georgians who pulled the lever for Governor Kemp and Senator Warnock to change their minds. It certainly doesn't feel like he's made enough progress on that mission, and he's running out of time." And he's not the only Republican in Georgia to essentially be saying, you know, we got a bad candidate here.
And that's why Republicans, when it was clear that this was going to a runoff, Republican sources told me that it is essential that Brian Kemp gets heavily involved in this race to convince those Republicans who didn't vote for, that voted for him, didn't vote for Walker, to vote for Walker a second time. So we'll see. The race is in a week, less than a week.
And it's not just the candidate. I think the candidate has been disappointing to Republicans who support him. But if you are running, this is campaign 101. If you have somebody who has lived in two states or lived in several states, you have to clean all this. You clean all this up months ago. You don't have a guy on the campaign trail yesterday saying, "I've lived in Georgia all my life," when you know, because the K-File team reaches out to them to comment, that there's audio of him saying, I live in Texas.
And it was well known that he was living in Dallas. He played for the Cowboys. He was living in the Dallas area. That's sort of a well-known fact. And to your point, John, this is not the first time that somebody has run for the Senate after having lived in a different state. There's a long history of that in both parties, but they do it with some delicacy and even precision. They explain why they're there. They perhaps do a listening tour of said state, and they set it up in a way that Herschel Walker just never did. And I think it's emblematic of the challenges with his candidacy at large. It was never done with any sort of obvious and sort of meticulous rationale. It was sort of done on the fly. Why? I think a lot of Republicans saw the Trump example and took all the wrong lessons from it, okay? That you can just make it up as you go and sort of steamroll your way through. Media accountability doesn't matter anymore. None of that counts. And guess what? Gravity does still apply.
And to the gravity point, the Warnock campaign has now just decided in the final days to, this is their latest ad, to just essentially tell, they make their case to the people of Georgia that this man is not up to serving in the United States Senate.
"So I've been telling this little story about this bull out in the field with six cows, and three of them are pregnant.
There's no substance. There's nothing.
It makes me want to laugh,
And then it makes me think we're in trouble.
Focus groups, yeah. being right. I mean, folks who work in politics or cover politics know what that is. Right. Those are focus groups that every campaign does, where they test what can be a positive or a negative message on themselves and their opponents. We just don't see it on the air very often.
I think it's one here of the most effective ads. It's essentially saying to, you know, Georgian voters, do you want this guy to represent right. you? Does he seem like somebody who could stand in the Senate, you know, well, and give a speech about anything coherently and represent the values and the views of Georgians? And so, yeah, I mean, they are going all in. You see sort of the diversity of that focus group, those are the voters they need to show up, if you're Walker.
And the voters they also need to keep home, the Republican voters who they don't want to show up.
Yeah. That's a great point. It works both ways. Up next for us, South Dakota's governor takes on TikTok. And Washington may soon follow suit, as critics say all those catchy dance videos are essentially a direct data pipeline to China and the Communist Party. TikTok is clearly in for a political storm. South Dakota's Republican Governor Kristi Noem is banning the popular Chinese-owned app on government devices in her state, citing national security concerns. And lawmakers in both parties here in Washington want to ban or at least significantly restrict TikTok on grounds all those catchy videos are a giant data boom to the Chinese Communist Party. With us to discuss our CNN national security analyst and the former Director of National Intelligence, Deputy Director of National Intelligence, Beth Sanner. So let me read from Kristi Noem's announcement. She says, if you're a state employee and you have a device that's owned by the state, that the state gives to you, South Dakota will have no part in the intelligence gathering operations of nations who hate us. The Chinese Communist Party uses information that it gathers on TikTok to manipulate the American people. There's no argument with that on the facts, right?
There's a little bit on the facts. I mean, it is not completely clear that TikTok is the source of information that the Chinese government uses to influence Americans. But they have lots of other means of getting information, and TikTok could be that. But I think right now this is kind of a political statement in a lot of ways.
A political statement because sounding tough on China and sounding tough on the CCP is something that gets you head waves within the Republican Party. But a lot of Democrats are doing it as well. This is Mark Warner, the Democratic chair of the Intelligence Committee. Democrats will keep the Senate, so he will remain chairman. Mm-hmm. He says it's a problem.
I think Donald Trump was right. I mean, TikTok is an enormous threat. So if you're a parent and you got a kid on TikTok, I would be very, very concerned. All of that data that your child is inputting and receiving is being stored somewhere in Beijing.
That's a Democrat. This is Mike Gallagher, a Republican House member, but who's working with a Republican senator.
TikTok should be banned. Senator Marco Rubio and I have legislation that does exactly that. TikTok is digital fentanyl, addicting our kids. And just like actual fentanyl, it ultimately goes back to the Chinese Communist Party.
The fentanyl part is a little over the top in the sense that, you know, that fentanyl is such a deadly problem.
Right.
But the idea that you have bipartisan people talking about either banning it or significantly restricting it is that you think some of the rhetoric is over the top. Does this need to be scrubbed? Does it need a close look?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think that, you know, here's the thing, that we don't really know exactly what is going on with this data and where it's going. But we know that the parent company in China has to give information. It's part of China's legal system. They have to give all this information up to the Chinese government. And they are hoovering it up. And there's a reason that my college-age kid does not have it on his phone and will never do it. And he gets it. So, I mean, we do have to be worried about this, absolutely. But I do also think that we have to be smart about this. And I'm not sure a ban is actually going to work. There is a process where the CFIUS, which is, you know, part of a U.S. committee that is currently looking at this, they may put this into a situation where they create a firewall and there is a way that you can monitor and prevent that data from going to China. That might be the best step forward. But I think there are going to be a lot of Republicans who then will say, well, that's not enough because you're not being hard enough on China.
Well, these conversations or similar conversations did come up during the Trump presidency.
Absolutely.
And you have this.
I was there.
You have this. Yeah, you have the letter from the House incoming. These will be chairmen now on the House side. They were ranking members, or they're still ranking members today. James Comer and Kathy McMorris-Rogers say TikTok told staff TikTok does not track users' internet data, while not using the application, and that China-based employees do not have access to the U.S. users' location-specific data. Both claims appear to be misleading at best, at worst, false. Is there evidence that the U.S. subsidiary, essentially, of TikTok has lied to Congress?
There appears to be. I mean, there were some press reports out this summer, which I think look very credible, which were leaks of internal conversations, recorded conversations from TikTok internal meetings that indicated that China was having access to all this information. Plus, you have all the code being written for this in China. And we know that they periodically allow the coders in and out of the system. So, you know, I think it would be naive of us to think that China isn't hoovering up this information.
And quickly, the idea that, you know, many legitimate questions about China from A to Z, about their operations, where should this be on the list?
I think that TikTok is one of those things that it's easy in some ways to get your head around. I don't think it's the most important thing. I'm actually more worried about and applaud the Biden administration's banning of Huawei, ZTE, and the videos that we have near, for example, some of our U.S. military installations. That worries me a lot more because there are other ways that China is hoovering up Americans' information.
We'll continue the conversation. Beth, thanks for coming in. Up next for us, House Democrats pass the baton, and they make history as they elect new leaders. And on the Republican side, Kevin McCarthy is making deals. Why? Because he's still short the votes to become House Speaker. Soon up on Capitol Hill, the new Democratic House leadership team will hold a news conference. It's the first time in two decades that Nancy Pelosi will not be the Democratic leader. Now, the changes don't officially take effect until the new Congress convenes in January. But the votes today mean Hakeem Jeffries will succeed Pelosi. That means the 52-year-old New Yorker, you see him right there, will be the first black American and the first person of color to serve as a congressional party leader. His new deputies, Catherine Clark of Massachusetts, she will serve as whip. Pete Aguilar of California will be the new Democratic caucus chairman. Our great reporters back at the table. Just giant that Nancy Pelosi, after two decades as a Democratic leader, will be gone. Time of transition in both parties in the House congressional leadership. How is Hakeem Jeffries different than Nancy Pelosi in what he cares most about or how he runs things?
It's a good question. We're going to see. So my sources are telling me, people, lawmakers, aides, think that the trio of Aguilar, Clark, and Jeffries are going to be able to make up what Pelosi had in one. And they think that that's going to be good for the conference. They think that all three of them are going to be needed and necessary. But it's also a good place in the minority to learn the job. And they're going to have that benefit. They're going to have to work with Kevin McCarthy, perhaps, who's going to have his own challenges. It's going to be chaos for him for the next 2 years. So it's going to be interesting to see how both parties interact. But hardly anyone has a relationship with Kevin McCarthy.
It's a new team after the team that served for 20 years, which makes it interesting and challenging to begin with. Is it easier to get your sea legs, if you will, as the opposition party, as opposed to having to be responsible for passing things?
You know, I don't think either of these jobs are going to be easier. I mean, I think it'll be different. It'll be more about sort of messaging and kind of defining what the Democratic Party stands for in opposition to what the Republicans stand for. I think it's helpful for that trio that Nancy Pelosi is still going to be there. I think they decided to give her some sort of honorary Speaker Emeriti title or something. So I imagine she'll still be involved in sort of mentoring and guiding the way of this new trio of folks.
To that point, Nancy Pelosi becomes Speaker Emerita. I went to Latin school. I should know how to say that. That one's going to get me in trouble. but today, David Cicilline, Democratic congressman from Rhode Island, says he will challenge. Jim Clyburn wanted to stay on as an assistant in the leadership. He was the number three. Yeah. He wanted to stay on in a number four, another spot in the leadership. David Cicilline says it's important for the Democratic Party to have a member of the LGBTQ community in its leadership, and he's going to mount that challenge.
Yeah. Yeah, it was a pretty smooth transition that sort of took place in a few hours' time here between the three octogenarians, Pelosi, Hoyer, and Clyburn, and the new three Democratic leaders. But I think Clyburn's decision to try to stay at the table, even in more of a symbolic role, clearly didn't sit well with younger members of the House Democratic Caucus who have been agitating for years for generational turnover. And I think when people like Cicilline saw Pelosi and Hoyer step down, and then Clyburn tried to sort of semi-stay I think it didn't go over that well. And I think, look, it's an ambitious crowd by its very nature. They're congressmen, right?
And they've been waiting a long time for a chance to be ambitious.
They're waiting a long time for this. And they saw Pelosi and Hoyer leave, and they said, no, there should be a full turnover for all those slots that the three currently occupy. And no, the Clyburn sort of semi-post is not enough. He should step down too, a la Pelosi and Hoyer. Look, I don't think it's going to work. I think there's enough regard for Jim Clyburn in the caucus that he'll keep the post that he's aspiring to. But it does get to the sort of angst in the caucus here that hasn't been fully resolved, even with Pelosi leaving.
Let's quickly deal on the Republican side. Kevin McCarthy has until January 3rd, right, or January 4th if it carries over. That's when they pick a speaker on the floor of the House of Representatives. He is still short the votes. He had meetings yesterday. He calls them the family, different factions of the Republican Party in his office. On the way out, Jim Jordan, a key member of the Freedom Caucus, said, quote, "We had a breakthrough." Ralph Norman, one of the Republicans who has said, "I will not vote for Kevin McCarthy," says, "I'm open to negotiating anything." Kevin McCarthy willing to somehow renegotiate the rules, apparently, of how things work, how powerful the speaker is. Do we have any evidence? Did he move the ball at all forward? Did the ball go backwards? Is he status quo? Do we know?
I'm only laughing a little bit because this is going to be an everyday occurrence for the next couple of years if Kevin McCarthy becomes Speaker of the House. The fact that he had Marjorie Taylor Greene in the room on his behalf, he is using her as his latest weapon to kind of corral the far right. He's going to have to be a peace broker for the foreseeable future. But his first task, as you said, he has to get 218 votes, and he's not there yet, and he is working extremely hard to get it.
Yeah, and he's to keep everybody in line, right, as he's speaker. I mean, we've seen what has happened to prior speakers who've been run out of town by this more right-wing part of the Republican Party. You know, I think this was his dream job. I think it's going to be a tough one to keep. If he gets it.
There's no room for error. He can only lose four votes, and I think today, I think he'll have a hard time.
Up to Capitol Hill, the new House Democratic leadership team. Let's listen.
As the incoming House Democratic leader for the 118th Congress that will convene.
Now streaming exclusively on Max, a new CNN flash doc about the album that has Nashville talking, Call Me Country, Beyonce and Nashville's Renaissance. Watch it at max.com/callmecountry. Max subscription required.